Hey, it's the JRR You Talking to Me podcast, and I don't see anybody else here, but I do because it's Jude Fox. Hey, Jude, are you talking to me?
I will be sailing to you today.
Ooh, sailing. He's sailing away across the Sundering Sea.
It's sundering.
Oh, boy. I love the Sundering Sea. But we're not in the Sundering Sea no more. We are in Forada, episode 3. What does that mean?
I believe that means father. The man who told me this is not with us today.
Rowan.
Yep.
You want to know what's going on with him, don't you?
I'm sure everyone wants to know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you. Remember a couple of episodes of the first episode, we said he had a little bit of a medical condition. Right?
Yep.
And it was a perianal cyst that he had removed.
That is correct.
It's like an entangled hair mass. Anyway, so he is on his belly, healing up, but he's got a crevasse that needs to be attended to, and he lives alone. So he has a nurse aide come over, and she's been tending to his bandages, and, you know, they hit it off a little bit. And they went away. They went to upstate Elmira, New York, this weekend.
There's nothing sexier than than meeting in those circumstances.
Yeah, he still needs a change. Like she still. And I asked her. I said, "What's her name?" And he just said, "O'Leary." Like, is that her first name? Is that her last name? I was like, he said he didn't know. Just O'Leary. So that's where he is. He's with O'Leary. In Elmira, and she's cozying up to him and changing his bandages. I don't know. Doesn't sound professional. But anyway, so we cut. Let's go through the scene by scene of Ada for Ada.
Let's get to it.
Adirondir is being dragged. He is completely disoriented and coming to, and he's being dragged through the orc trenches. Or tunnels. They look more like trenches to me. How about you, Jude?
Yeah. It's not completely clear. I think it would appear that what we've seen earlier on in the more tunnel-like crevasses and caverns that Arondir first found seem to branch off from what we're seeing now.
But now we have chained, enslaved men of the South and elves of the South as well. But
few elves.
You know what the orcs don't want, what they don't like when they're at their day job?
They do not like trying to get a tan.
They do not like the sunlight. They hate it, and they don't want to go into sun duty. So this tells us that they are very vulnerable to light, which will come into play later. But the orcs argue about who gets sun duty because they have to throw a Rondir. They have to chain him up in the sun.
Yeah, sun duty is kind of like duty for most people.
It's crappy. They don't like it. I had sun duty. But anyway, they'll do it for Ada. So guess who's there? Guess who? Who's there? Who does he see? He sees Meadhor. Now, this is 0% chance, people, that that's actually pronounced Meadhor. But that's how I pronounce it, because that's, I just think it's kind of funny.
I think it's a less than zero chance.
Meadhor. But it doesn't matter.
Meadhor.
We know what's going to happen.
Meadhor.
So, and he's with another elf whose name is Revion.
Yes.
Revion. And they're all, they're enslaved.
Revion was the watchtower guard or commander, I believe.
Right. And they're enslaved, and they are... Okay, so yep, Meadhor and Revion, the gang's all there, being abused by orcs. So now we cut to Galadriel, and she wakes up on a ship. They were saved, but Halbrand gives her some food, and even before she takes a bite, she's like, "Are these saviors or are they captors? Because if they're captors, I don't know if I want this." And he's like, "Nah, relax, it's not poison for men."
Yeah, she doesn't really appreciate his joke. It doesn't look like she...
You know, Galadriel doesn't... She doesn't joke. Not yet, anyway. So we meet Elendil. He is the captain of the ship. He's the Numenorean captain.
Yeah, so Elendil the Tall, he's called in the books.
But he ain't that tall in the show.
How tall is he supposed to be? Do you remember?
6'9".
7'11".
Six nine. That was Robert Baratheon. 7'11"? Come on.
Yes, he's supposed to be almost 8 feet tall.
That's a little crazy.
So they changed that, but the actor is terrific, so I have no issue with that.
So the Numenoreans are these ubermensch, but not so much physically in this. Anyway, so Elendil is taking them to Home, and Home turns out to be Numenor. And it seems that he has Galadriel's dagger, she notices. He took that from her. So now we see the splendor of Numenor and the big stone-carved heads. We're not exactly sure what those heads are. Are those the gods? Are those the Valar, Jude?
Yeah, I think we're not really clear just yet, but the imagery is just spectacular. It's really a beautiful, beautifully realized depiction, I think.
Yep. But we do see two paternal-looking figures.
Yep.
And we think one is Eärendil, and one is his son Elros, who is the first king and founder of Numenor. He chose the mortal man life, whereas his brother Elrond chose to be an elf. They had a choice. That's a backstory. We'll get to that in the Helm's Deep dive.
Yes, indeed. And as they're entering, we see a signal fire lit, much like we did in Return of the King, which just kind of shows the progression of this culture.
Right. So Galadriel explains to Halbrand that the men who stood with the elves were the men who created this city. And his ancestors stood with Morgoth. So.
Yeah, she.
You suck, Halbrand. Your ancestors stood with Morgoth. Check out what these guys have. But also.
She's incredibly condescending.
Kind of, but you know what? There's a heavy anti-elf vibes going on, and we're going to see later that that's been going on for
generations.
And so she says the Valar gave them this island. That's a little exposition there. She explains that the lore of the Numenoreans, which is they fought Morgoth on the side of the elves, the Edain, the men of the West. And they were rewarded with this Paradise Island. And so the elves are now being turned away. Literally, their ships are being turned away. And she is being taken through the streets. And people are like, did you see the elf? The ears. Did you see her? And so now we're taken to the center of the city, in the political center. I guess this is the capital. And Farazôn and Myriel, Farazôn is the advisor to the queen at this point. I don't think he's taken over. But Myriel is the queen regent.
Yes.
And they're not holding court, but they're kind of in a court-like room, a giant hall. And they're all congregating in groups, and they're yapping. I think there were some bagels in the corner. Did you see the bagels?
It looked like they had a pretty nice spread laid out there.
That's... Oh, you're going to hear my doggie's having a bad dream. Thorin, Oakenshield, you will be okay. He thinks Azog is defiling him, people, in his dream. So anyway.
That Azog.
So, Farazôn and Myriel are talking to different groups, but then an elf comes in and the guard just lets her right in because that's a big deal. And the crowd silences. And then upon seeing Galadriel, she and Halbrand are about to kneel down at Halbrand's bequest. He recommends that, but the queen says no. No one kneels in Numenor.
We don't do that here.
No. Just stand up, all right?
Show a little respect for yourself.
Yeah. But we don't like you. Because you're an elf. Anyway... Galadriel explains with great fanfare who she is, from the House Finarfin, and she works for Gil-galad, the High Elf, and she is the commander of the Northern Armies.
Gil-galad.
Gil-galad. And Halbrand just is like, hey, I'm Halbrand. Hey, I'm from the Southlands.
What's up, y'all?
Just little old me, Halbrand. Just little old me, Sauron. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. We'll Episode 3?
We'll get into that.
No, I don't think so. Good theories behind it. Interesting conversation, but I think it is just a little bit of a red herring. So anyway, Galadriel asks for ships and passage to Middle-earth. And they don't do this for the elves anymore.
No, the only passage she's going to get is straight downhill.
Yeah, maybe back in the day. Maybe way, way, way back in the early days of Numenor. But not since my great-grandfather, his daddy. We don't do that. But Muriel also argues that, hey, the Numenors paid for this, in this island in blood. We deserve this place. The elves didn't give it to us. The gods did.
And Galadriel explains that she's very willing to pay in blood to get what she needs.
Oh, yeah. They're ready to throw down. The animosity escalates quickly between these two ladies.
I would have liked to have the suggestion that, you know, she wants to pay in blood. Just cut off those little pointy ears and you ain't no elf no more.
Ooh, but you're still enough. You're still immortal.
You know,
you still emerge from the sea without your nipples showing.
Who knows how it works?
So, but Halbrand, he's a smooth talker, isn't he? He's a smooth talker.
Almost too smooth.
Is he Sauron?
Mm-hmm.
The devil, that blue-eyed devil. Does Halbrand have blue eyes? Does he have a blue dress? I don't think so.
He might, you know, so, you never know what someone's into.
Devil with the blue dress on.
We got it. It wasn't good.
You got it.
I got it.
Well, it's just a reference.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
So he's very diplomatic. He's like, if you get to know us for a few days, me, G, she's nice once you get to know her. She's a bit stabby and cutty.
Just
and
a little.
She's an ice troll. She's an icy lady. But Halbrand also, he fake hugs. Oh, wait, but you know what? Farazan, he agrees to the deal because he wants to get this over with, this elf business. But he's kind of condescending. He's a bit of an elf Farazan dick.
Yeah, we get people laughing at Galadriel's expense as he speaks.
She's a fierce, legendary elven warrior who's thousands of years old. Ha ha ha. Commander of the Northern Armies of Gil-galad. So, Halbrand, he steals the dagger. He gives Elendil a big hug. Hey, bro, man, thanks for pulling me out of the sea. I love you, bro. And he just slickly takes the dagger. Did Elendil know? Was he? Come on.
I think he knew. I don't think there's a huge mystery to that, and it's going to come up again rather soon. And,
he ain't no dummy.
No.
You don't become commander of the Captain of the Sea. Is that his title, Commander of the Captain of the Sea?
I'm pretty sure it's not. But
for no reason.
Yeah.
So Halbrand, he, in a private conversation with Galadriel right around the corner there, he's like, I really don't want to go back to the Southlands. That place sucks. This orc's whipping you, and I don't like it. I just want to stay here and maybe get a job and be at peace, and you should want that too.
Yeah, he's not real down with the defilement.
No. It's a lot of sexual tension there, and then he gives her dagger back.
He does now, huh?
Yep. Jude?
That's clearly a metaphor, a euphemism, if you will.
Well,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
So, and he says this interesting thing. He says, I've been searching for my peace for longer than you know.
Once again, implying that maybe he's a little older than we think. But I'm beginning to think that
and
that's
what
a,
is his peace?
Yeah, I'm beginning to think that that's a misdirect, that there's perhaps a few misdirects and it'll keep going.
Yep, I think so. And then we get back to Farazan and Muriel, and he tells her an avalanche can start with one stone, meaning one elf can cause a whole mess of trouble in Numenor. And you don't want to invite your father's cloud back over our heads.
Yeah, so, that after chilly night, that cloud was not pleasant.
No, woo, the brown cloud. No, so her father was, he was in an unpopular faction because he wanted to repent to the gods, and he became a very devout, faithful follower of the Valar. And the Numenoreans are divided, and most of them are the king's men, and they're political and they're military, and they want to take over control of parts of Middle Earth, at least in the text. So there's two definite factions. But anyway, at the end of the scene, we get some exposition about Elendil and Isildur, his son. And apparently they were noble. They were from a noble line, and now they he serves as a sea captain.
Yeah.
So, back in old country, I was a neurologist. Now I work at Best Buy. I mean, that's how they... I mean, no, to be a captain of the sea in Numenor is a great honor, too, but they seem to look at it as a dissension, right?
Right. Well, you know, from nobility to sea captaincy, it seems to be a step down in the eyes of the ruling class there.
But he likes it.
Yeah, you know, he wants to be in the salt air and feel the wind on his face. He doesn't want to be cooped up in some tower somewhere. Come
and,
on.
His son has followed him into his service. And speaking of which, we cut to Isildur. And he's at sea, and he's busting his ass, moving fast. But then all of a sudden, I think it's the Western Shore, calls out his name. Isildur.
Very sexy.
Oh, boy. And he's entranced for a second, and then something happens, something slips up, and one of his fellow cadets, they're in danger, and he springs into action. Now, were they endangered by Isildur's absent-mindedness, or am I reading into that? Did he save the day there? Did he cause the problem?
I was not picking up on him being the cause of it. I felt that this was much more of of his moment to shine. You know, we get to see him stepping up in a way that will feed into his character later on. It's very much skinny Steve Rogers jumping on the grenade when he has no powers.
Right.
You know, it's that sort of moment.
So, and then the captain of that vessel yells out, "There's no harsher master than the sea." And he's training them. He's not only a cat, he's like a drill sergeant of the sea.
Yeah, I used to know a dominatrix that would say the same thing to me.
I think everybody says that to you for some reason.
You know,
I've seen little kids just walk up to Jude. "There's no harsher master than the sea. You know that?" He just brings the harsher master of the sea thing out of people. Anyway.
I don't want to get into it. Can we move on, please? His fellow cadets...
They get to the shore, and the captain is facing them as they're pulling their ships in to shore. And he says, "The sea is always right." And they repeat that. They chant that back to him. "The sea is always right." And that's going to come up later. But his fellow cadets, Velendil and Antamo, they say his head was in the clouds today. "Hey, man, get back in the game. Is he?" And so Isildur, they begin a little bit of a conversation about hopeful talk about their sea careers, and they got their their trial or whatever is coming up, and then in 4 years they get to do this and that, and they're talking about their career. And then his sister, Eärien, she's a beautiful maiden bringing him his horse. And his friends kind of flirt with her innocently, then he asks her, "Where's father?" So, and then we find out where Elendil is. He is with Miriel, the queen regent, and they're looking at the White Tree of Numenor, and she explains the lore behind the tree, and this beautiful white tree, the falling leaves represent the tears of the Valar, who watch over them in judgment. But then she pretends to be, or maybe really is, we don't know, skeptical. And she's like, do you believe that? Do you believe that shit? Really? Are you religious? Because I'm not. And then she really wants to know more about his relationship to the elven people. Jude, what do you think about that?
Yeah, she questions him a bit. She questions him about who he serves, about his name, and what it means.
What does he tell her it means?
Well, he says that his name means one who loves the stars.
And then she's like, yeah, what else? She knows.
Yeah, she knows.
She knows. You know what? Don't mess with me, Elendil. Elf friend. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
And he kind of blushes.
He's like, yeah, it's me.
Yep. And she's like, what are you doing bringing an elf here? Really? You got an elf? I think there's more to this, though, than her just being dismayed about an elf being there. We're going to see that later on. Then she goes to say that elves have been unwelcome in Numenor since the reign of her grandfather's great-grandfather. And they live a long time, the Numenoreans.
Yeah, we have not heard talk of that in the show yet, which I'm curious to see how that's going to come, whether what the lifespan of the Numenoreans is or if they have changed that for the show. But right now it's still up in the air. But generally, they live a minimum of 200 years. Some, such as Elros, as long as 500.
But as they became less faithful, they lived less long. And that's their longevity was decreasing.
Yeah, so although, like, in later years, once we get into the Third Age and we have our well-known hero, Aragorn, who is the descendant of their bloodline. I believe he ends up with a fairly long lifespan. He's 87 when we meet him.
I think 97.
87 when we meet him.
He's in his 90s when she asks him how old he is. Yeah, I think so.
It's 87. But anyway.
It's 97.
Well, you know, we're going to need to ask Rowan on this one, and he's going to... You know, I have to prove that I'm right. That's not really.
I think, yeah, it's in the. Well, I don't. I guess, are you talking about in the movie? I think he was 97. I don't know. And it doesn't matter. Anyway, so. He's just. He is a dyed in the wool sailor at this point, and he says, the sea put her in my way. And as they said, as they had the cadets chant back, the sea is always right. So he. But you got to have. Faith in the gods to think that way, I believe.
Yes.
So,
definitely faith in a power that is greater than our own.
Now, Muriel is pretending to be faithless, I believe. And then she say, well, you know, the sea can't be charged with treason. But you can, unless you do me a service.
That sounds sexy.
It, you know, when Muriel, she ain't half bad.
Oh.
I have to say, give him service, but then she gives him a sword.
No, that's just kinky.
There you go. So she gives him a sword, and so it's going to turn out, we're just a little foreshadowing, that Muriel doesn't have the point of view that you think she might. Anyway, we're back. Meadhor tells Arandir that the passage, the orc trenches, it leads all the way to Hordern. Hordern.
All this whorish etymology.
And it hides the orcs and shields them from the light. So that's why no one sees him coming when they come up through that World War I style ditch that Mr. Tolkien probably was indelibly marked in his memory.
Indeed.
So, and that Meador also suggests that they're searching for something, and I think we know.
Well, what do you think they're searching for?
Theo's blade, the blade of Sauron that Theo found and took with him, and they want to give it back to their revered leader, Adar. I'll do it for Adar, but I won't do it for you, Lenny Moskowitz, but I'll do it for Adar. He's great. I love Adar. Did you see his last concert? He killed.
Literally.
So Revion, he plots. that they're going to make their escape when the sun is in the highest. They're going to rebel. They're going to break their chains. They're going to use the light to fight the orcs. If one of them can survive and get back and get reinforcements, they can sweep the enemy from these lands like salt from a table. And Jude, what do you think of that salt from a table metaphor?
I take a little issue with this because in medieval times, salt was more valuable, or at least as valuable by weight, as gold, because it was so important to survival. And I just feel that...
Because of the pretzels?
You gotta love the pretzels. But for a world such as this, salt would still be so important a commodity that to just sweep salt from a table seems a little out of character, in my opinion, for the dialogue. And let me point out, I like the dialogue in this episode quite a bit. I just think that while it's a cool-sounding line, it feels a little off to me.
Yeah. But, you know, I was indifferent to the salty part of it. Revian won't... He's not going to tear down that tree. They come up to a tree, and he's like, that tree... fuck you, orcs.
No, sir, not going to do it.
No.
Nope.
You know why? Because that tree deserves to be here. And you shitty orcs, you crawled out of the mud and the slime, and I hate your orc faces. You really shouldn't say that to your captors who have whips.
No, there is a little bit of racial hatred going on there, and probably not the best time to bring
it
up.
So then his name is Magrat. Magrat, the orc. He comes up with the water from behind, and he's like, no, well done. And he likes Revian's show. He shows strength, and he deserves a water ration.
Earn this.
I don't know about you, but like, I'm not the type of guy I'm reluctant to return my food if something's wrong with it. At like, you know, an Outback or something. Like, I'm afraid that people are going to mess with it. They're going to do something nasty to it in the background. You know, I don't know. You know, you never know. That guy could be back there. Is that, you know, the Caesar dressing? Who knows what that is?
Hey, we've all seen Fight Club.
Right. Exactly. So when an orc is smiling and giving you a thing of water, you got to be pretty thirsty to take it.
Yeah, it's a little bit suspicious.
He's like, come on, drink it.
They're all kind of giggling.
Yeah, what did they do to that water? Don't drink the orc water.
Hey, look, you know, even if they didn't do anything to it, just the fact that they've been drinking from that thing, you know they're backwashing.
Oof, God. Yeah, don't share a beer with an orc.
Yeah. Orc backwash? Not pleasant.
No.
I can tell you from personal experience.
It's like the head on a Guinness. Which is good, but the same consistency. Anyway, so Revian, he drinks the water, and next is Arandir, and he's like, but he's drinking it because they're thirsty. And then guess what? Our man Midor. What happens when he goes to drink
the water? Oh, he just throws his head back, you know, taking it like it was bukkake. And,
God.
And that is the wrong position to be in.
My ex-band, Orc Bukkake.
It's definitely the wrong position to be in.
We played smooth jazz.
Very smooth.
Yes. So Midor gets his throat cut by Magrat. He's like, no, I didn't say you, bitch.
And what do you feel his blade was made out of? Because it had to be like a paper dagger that he used. Because that was a paper cut. That was just a little thin hairline slice, no blood.
Where was the blood swooshing out of it?
I can't explain it.
It was a plastic knife he cut him with. So Arandir says, all right, I'll just cut down the tree. But then he asks for the tree's forgiveness because that's how elves are.
Yeah, and the type of elf they are is also significant,
right?
Because they're essentially a type of wood elf. He is Sylvan.
He's a Sylvan elf.
And
he goes to the Sylvan Elf Learning Center.
He does. It's remedial, but, you know, we still like him.
Yeah. He's getting algebra. He's starting to get it.
And I think something important to note also is the fact that the word Adar comes from the Sindarin elven, which is the type of elven that the both the Sindarin and Sylvan elves would speak, which is different from what Galadriel would speak, but it's the same as what Arondir would speak.
Okay. So now we cut to Galadriel, and she has escaped cat-like through the window. She is so graceful, she is. She's got such rhythm when she walks.
She's just a regular Arya Stark. She's in the streets.
She covers them elf ears up. That's the thing. You got to cover up them elf ears. What? You know, just... It's hard to sometimes. They stick out. So Elendil's... he's got her number, though. The soldiers can't find her. They're doofuses. They make a little joke about, you go tell him. I told him last time. That was a dog. This is an elf. It's a little different.
It's hysterical. They should do stand-up.
So Elendil comes up, and he's like, I would use this ship if I were escaping, if it was me. I got you. I'm behind you. I'm an elf friend, don't worry. I like the elves. So she takes her dagger that she got back from Halbrand, and she holds it to his throat.
And is he surprised that she has it?
Not really.
No, he knew.
So and he says to her, I have a daughter who runs fast and a son who runs blind, and your eyes bear a striking resemblance to both. And she says, I'm like 75,000,000 years old, so shut up and stop treating me like a child. Basically, she's not that happy with him until he starts to speak Elvish. Not Elvis. Elvish. And then she kind of warms up to him real quick. And he says where he was raised in Western Numenor, a lot of people speak Elvish, and they revere the elves still there. So they're in that minority faction that is faithful to the gods and the elves. And they even have a hall of lore. And it's a quarter day's ride to the west. And she says, ride? Oh, me, oh, my.
Let's go now.
And they cut to a woman's underwear diaper commercial, basically. It's
a beautifully shot.
She's just loving riding that horse.
Absolutely gorgeous depiction of the landscape and the
depend beach undergarments
and this weird
smile
on Galadriel's face as she rides that horse.
Occasional bladder leakage? No problem. I can ride a horse again. So what's happening.
That being said, I mean, I'm sure we've all heard about women in olden times and bareback horseback riding.
Yeah, but not Galadriel.
You know, hey, you know what?
Not my Galadriel. Look, Jude, stop. I will fight you.
Let me tell you, we did not.
I will pay in blood.
We did not see the back of that horse when she got off, and I'm telling you, there could have been a spot.
I will pay in blood to support my lady Galadriel's virtue.
Just saying.
So we're going back to Halbrand. He's at the smithy. He's at the smithy looking for a gig, baby.
Yes, he is.
He wants a job. He wants a job. He's the best. He's the best at forging. The smith is making a harpoon. He said, I'll make you an anchor. It'll be the best mo-fucking anchor you ever seen.
He definitely knows how to hype himself up.
And the guy's like, I like you, dude. You got spunk. You got moxie, kid. But you need a guild crest. You need one of them little badges that'll hold on your tunic or whatever. And he says, okay, whatever. And then we cut to a scene, and he's eating the mussels. And outside, it looks like a beer garden. No, that's the other one. This one looks like a nice outdoor restaurant. I think he's in the village.
It does have that look and feel. It looks like a Mediterranean restaurant.
He's in Astoria, sort of. Basically. And he's eating mussels.
Non-New Yorkers are not going to get that reference.
He's eating mussels, and they look pretty good. And he's questioned by a bunch of Numenorean men, and they call him Low Man. And he's eating their food, their hospitality. They're pissed off at Low Man. They make fun of the she-elf closeness, and they're like, you know, wouldn't the she-elf would probably prefer us because we're better bred. And he starts to get a little mad, but then what does he do, Jude?
First he retorts with a...
You forgot the women.
Yeah.
I'm going to take them too.
Yeah. He definitely antagonizes them a little bit. But then he decides to hold his horses there, no pun intended about the earlier conversation, and... he buys them all a drink.
And he's the charmer of the whole group. By the end of the day, they're all like, Halbrand rocks. They all love him.
This is basically the Middle Earth equivalent of the scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure in the biker bar.
Yeah.
By the end, you know, they're basically patting him on the shoulders and they're ready to give him a horse to ride out on, just about.
Yep. But he did a bad thing. He stole the guy's guild crest.
Yeah, he didn't get him drunk enough, apparently.
No, he wasn't slick enough, and they come around the corner, and they corner him in an alley, and they start kicking, not kissing. They're kissing his little tookish.
That's a different show entirely.
They start kicking his ass, and then he hulks out. Not physically, just... skill-wise, and he just beats the living shit out of them. And he breaks the guy's radius and ulna bones.
Yep.
The forearm just snaps it like a twig.
He basically just turns into Shang-Chi for a quick minute.
We're adding a little Sauron-y goodness to fool people and put them on the wrong trail. Or maybe he is Sauron.
Well, we definitely know that he's been modest about his ability to hold his own so mm-hmm. far.
Right.
In a fight.
But then the guards come with the big spears and they capture him.
Yeah,
at spear point.
He does not try to fight his way out of that.
No, they're going to...
He accepts it.
They're coming to take him away, Barbara. So now we're at the Hall of Lore. We rode all the way to the west of Numenor. And this hall, she's a Galadriel. She's pretty impressed.
Yeah,
she's been to a lot of libraries, and this one's really nice.
This is like the Library of Alexandria, it seems.
So this one, you know who built this, Jude?
I'm guessing it was Elros.
It was Elros himself.
And himself.
And then...
himself?
And then Elros... It was built, that's what he says, it was built by Elros himself.
Ah, himself.
And she knows him. She knew him. She's like, Elros.
Oh, yeah, that dude.
Owes me money. So, she's like, I like his brother Elrond a little better.
I was always a little closer to his brother.
Yeah, I'm an Elrond gal. You know why? Because he's an elf. We all stick together. But the last king... before Mariel, her father, he's still alive, and he is very faithful to the gods, and he has had them keep the Hall of Lore. That's why it still exists.
And that would be Tar Palantir.
They're not going to say that, probably. They're probably not going to name him, because he's named that in the Silmarillion, and his story is pretty well outlined in the Silmarillion. But he was a faithful king who had a prophetic vision, and... this involves Galadriel, because an elf is supposed to come to Numenor, according to his vision. And I believe that this has to do with men fighting the enemy.
Right. And he in the book at least, took his name from the Palantirs, which are the seeing stones created by Finrond.
Fëanor.
Fëanor, sorry. And
like the Silmarils.
Yes, and we know that... from the trailers, we will be seeing one of those at least turn up at some point in the show.
So now we know that this king, this faithful king, is in exile in the High Tower, self-imposed, and they are looking through the scrolls, and they come across a scroll of a human who was taken by Sauron, and he escaped the dungeons, and he took this information from those dungeons. And basically what Galadriel finds out is that the thing that she thought was simply a sigil of Sauron is actually a map of the Southlands. And it's a map of, and not only a map, but also a plan to build an evil realm in the South in the event that Morgoth is defeated. And so, and the Southlands are just the beginning of the evilness that is going to spread throughout Middle-earth unless they go and fight this.
Well, what could that area possibly become? I mean,
I don't know. Maybe there... in the depths of Mordor, I met a maiden so fair. I met a girl so fair. But Gollum, the evil one, crept up and slipped away with her. Yeah.
Tolkien would be proud.
Yes, Mr. Robert Plant, as he said. So the Harfoots.
Ah, the Harfoots.
We're back to the Harfoots. Sadduk. He's a Harfoot. And he's leading the children in a little bit of an exercise. And he shouts out, "Nobody goes off trail." And they retort with, "And nobody walks alone. Nobody goes off trail and nobody walks alone." These Harfoots are scared. They are going to die at any second. So they have a lot of rituals. And anyway, Marigold and Largo, we cut to a shot of them and they're talking. And it's their love story. It's their backstory. It's so well done. It's a very charming story. When Largo lost his first wife, Rose, he was in the toilet, basically. And then he saw her, Marigold, and he said that he was going to grow old with her. And he says, "Don't worry, we'll stay in front of the caravan. And also, Nori, she'll figure it out."
Oh, yeah, we're cool.
She's an honor student. She'll figure it out. Nori, when she puts her head to something, she can do anything.
Yeah, the back of that cart, if you look really close, there's a bumper sticker saying, "My child is an honor student."
And nobody...
In the hole down the street.
And nobody goes off trail. So, now Nori, she is single-minded. And she enlists Poppy to help her get Sadduk's Book of the Stars for the Meteor Man to find that constellation. So Nori does eventually find the constellation with the help of Poppy, and it's kind of a comic scene where Poppy is directing her, and Sadduk comes in, and he's practicing his full carts and fuller bellies pre-migration speech. And Poppy sneakily is giving her directions to go to the left and go to the right, and Sadduk doesn't know what's going on, and she finds the right sheet with the constellation on it, and she's going to be able to give that to Meteor Man. But now Sadduk is leading the Harfoot pre-migration ritual, and they remember the dead who fell behind in past migrations. And now, so the thing is, Harfoots, they say nobody's left behind, and nobody, but they leave just about everyone behind. You get a splinter and you're left behind by the Harfoots. They learned the hard way that life is rough when you're a tiny little person.
Yeah, you start limping, they don't stop.
Nope.
They don't slow down. They do not help you out. You just, yeah, see ya. But metaphorically, they carry them in their hearts. Nope. So it's all good.
Right. And that's what this ritual is about. They're going through all the dead and the fallen, and they're saying why they did. And we're getting snows. They were trapped in the snow. Landslides. Wolves. Bees.
Because that guy was an idiot.
He's an idiot. But we love him. We love that dead idiot who died from bees. So,
what a horrible way to die, too.
But we're getting,
not the bees! Not the bees!
No, we're getting the anthropology behind why these creatures have their rituals, because survival for them is survival of the group, not survival of the individual. And Meteor Man finds the page with the constellation. But, you know, Meteor Man, he doesn't know that light and heat operate together physically in this world.
What is heat?
What is, you know, now he knows.
He's learning.
His paper with the constellation goes on fire because he's got it too close to the fire. Read it. And then we have our little bit of a comical Three Stooges moment where he...
Little Abbott and Costello, Three Stooges, Laurel and Hardy, just very classic slapstick comedy. Yeah.
He gets caught up in the shroud, like the Harfoots, where there's these shrouds, and he gets up. He
knocks
and
a bunch of stuff over.
They think he's a monster. But what does he say when they all look at him and they're staring at the monster? Well, they're all playing possum. They're great at hiding right away.
Yes, their instinct is to essentially hide or play dead. He just basically sells Nori right out.
Yeah, well, he doesn't know what's going on.
I believe the first thing he says is her name.
He says Nori. That's all he says. He's going to say something later, but...
And everyone kind of looks at her.
Yeah, and Sadak holds a little court there, and not a court-like thing, but casually, and he's like, you lied. Stolen from us. You brought a dangerous outsider, a giant, into our midst.
And she lied.
And she lied. She lied and she lied and she lied. And Nori questions the meaning of friendship for a Harfoot. So she is actually calling them out on their bullshit with the no one gets left behind.
Yeah,
what does friendship really mean?
They're like, friends? We don't need no stinking friends.
But they almost de-caravan them for breaking the law.
Almost.
So that would be horrible.
But not quite.
Nope, Sadak. You know, she hasn't grown the hair on her feet yet. She doesn't know what she's doing so much. Let them. But they have to go at the end. Back of the bus, all the way at the end.
Yeah.
And you can hear her father just, can we be in the middle of the end? You know, can we?
He's like, no.
No.
And Marigold essentially tells her that she may as well have writ their names in the Book of the Left Behind at this point. She is very pessimistic.
Right, and Nori is now having a conversation with Marigold, her mother, and she's saying she's not special. She's just a little Harfoot, but she's telling her that the Meteor Man, he is special. He's got a definite thing, and Marigold is having a hard time with this concept, and she says the tallest milkweed is the one that's going to get snipped. Don't stand out. And maybe that is even referring to Meteor Man's height, right? Being someone that's going to draw attention to these little Harfoots.
Yep.
So they're having a little argument. But you get the sense that Nori is respected by Marigold. So now we cut to a scene and we see it's a puppet show of Galadriel versus what I think is Galadriel versus Sauron, protecting the queen, and I imagine must be Miriel. And where are we? Well, we're at the Numenorean version of what?
Oktoberfest.
Bennigan's. Now he's hanging with his kids, eating. Apparently this is a more faithful area because of that puppet show, because they depict a heroic elf. But
possibly even a prophesized
scenario. This might be the prophecy. Anyway, Elendil is talking to Isildur, his son, and Eärien, his daughter, and he's a little frustrated with Isildur. He's having like a typical, like, my son is a fuck up kind of talk with him at first. He's frustrated that Isildur has given up on several different things, but then we realize that he's always given up for the same reason, and he's fighting with his call, I think, to be more faithful, as he was called to that western shore. And Elendil, I think, has had this same thing happen to him. He's had several deferments himself. And that's what Isildur is saying. He's going to defer from being in the navy there. So Elendil is frustrated. He says the past is dead. There's nothing on the western shores for us now. So what do you think, Jude? Do you think Elendil is... he's putting his foot down, but don't you think that he has respect for the situation that Isildur's in?
I think this is kind of a parent speaking to their kids about going to college, and the kid saying, yeah, I think I want to take a leap year. Right. I want to go off. I want to see the lands. I want to travel to all five points of the star.
Right. And he's saying you're going to, you know, don't end up like Anarion. I think Anarion, his brother, has been, there's some tension there, and he's not talking to Elendil, I get the sense.
Yeah, but this is all family problems that real people have in the real world.
Right. And he says, I know you have your doubts, son, about which way to go, but the watery part of the world can heal you. And, you know, but you're going to be on that boat. You're going to be on that ship. You're taking this gig.
Putting his foot down a little bit.
But then Isildur he is kind of validated from something else, something good that happened to his sister. He convinced her to reapply to the Builders Guild, and that plan, that advice, turned out to be very good, and she got in, and she made her apprenticeship. So Isildur...
Yeah, she got a scroll in the mail, it seems.
Right. So he's not an irresponsible fuck-up who just moves from thing to thing. He actually does have a good head on his shoulders and gives good advice. He's just torn between this world of being faithful and this world of being a warrior, a kingsman in the Navy.
Yep.
And his father had that same conflict, right? So now we go to Galadriel and Halbrand. And Halbrand is in jail. He always seems pretty chill, though.
It looks like it's not his first night in the tank.
No. And she says...
I think this happens, you know, once a fortnight.
The main theme here is you're more than you claim. Galadriel says to Halbrand, you're more than you claim.
No, like, who could he be?
So she thinks his sigil, she looked it up.
She did.
When she was in the Hall of Lore, I believe. And his sigil means he is an ancestor of a king, and he needs to be the king once again and unite his people against the enemy as his ancestor once did. And at first he brushes it off and he says, I just got that sigil off a dead man. Now, if you're a Sauron theorist, Halbrand is Sauron theorist, you're going to definitely remember that. Maybe he took it off the dead man because he was Sauron.
And killed him.
Yep.
But what are some of the other possibilities we're thinking for him based on what Galadriel is telling him?
Well, yeah, we're going to recap that, but we think that there are other possibilities. He could be the founder of Rohan.
That was a theory that came up on a Facebook page that I was visiting, and it's a quite sound theory.
Yep, there's a lot of things. We'll talk about that more in the deep dive. Helm's Deep Dive would be the perfect place for that conversation.
So it will be. So it Helm's will be. Deep. But so, but let's just get into. We also have the possibility of him, a strong possibility as a potential king, of him possibly being one of the Nazgul as well.
Yep. Maybe he's the Witch King.
These are all things to keep an eye on. Where I don't think either of us here, or poor Rowan, are really sold on any of these yet. I think it's a little too early to tell, but we're definitely entertaining all the possibilities.
Right. But the bottom line right now is in this conversation, she says that both their families can be redeemed by their action against the enemy right now. And she insists that they have a greater mission, both of them. But he reminds her that the ancestor, who may or may not be his ancestor, he's kind of saying, who got that sworn oath to Morgoth, and also lost, that he was basically a loser, and either became under the thrall of Morgoth, or in any case, lost. And so he might not be the right man. And even if he is, he's saying... what can we do? We're stuck here in Numenor with no army. And she looks at him and she knowingly says, that's about to change. And then we cut to Muriel and the queen, and she's actually talking to her father, saying the prophecy, that the dream that he had. Well, the elf is here. And so something is being put into motion. And it obviously involves the prophecy, the elf going to Numenor, and also facing the enemy. So we have some drama happening there. And what she says exactly is, it is here, Father. The moment we feared, the elf has arrived. They're not fearing the elf. They're fearing what happens when the elf arrives.
Yes, she would be the harbinger.
Right. Well,
of what's to come.
Right. And now we cut to the migration, and Largo, we know he twisted his ankle pretty bad.
Yeah, it looked like he broke it, but maybe he just twisted it. Either
That's
way,
just a he's blueberry.
Not, either way, he's not the one to really be running marathons right. and pulling carts.
So,
but he is.
And Nori has the great, let's throw Meteor Man in the back of the cart and have them pull it.
He's not going to be that heavy.
No, he's like 50 times the size of everything else in the cart. And poor Largo is pulling the cart. And he's like, let me just get my back under it. Oh, this sucks. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, we're going to fall behind. And then they put down the cart and rest for a second. And the cart starts shaking. And who is it? It's Meteor Man. And he gets out and he says, friend.
Ah.
Tell him it was your friend. Now, you better tell him it was Bigfoot, and he won't know which friend you mean. So anyway, Meteor Man says friend to Nori, and, I think we're liking Meteor Man.
And what's he do then?
What does Meteor Man do then?
Yep.
I don't know. What does he do then, Jude?
He begins to help with the cart.
Oh, he's going to. I don't think he just... starts right then, does he?
I believe we see him pick it up, and they start making their way to catch up to the caravan.
And we see the mountains, so it looks like they're heading maybe towards some mountains.
Because apparently, like, for him, pulling the cart's no big deal, you know?
It's a tiny little Harfoot cart.
It was really mean of them to make poor Largo try to pull it himself.
That was crazy. But they didn't want to know. They want people to know. Medium, now they can stay just behind so that they... And Meteor Man can protect him from the wolves. That we know that's going to happen.
Yes, we've... another moment spoiled by the trailer.
Right, but we can't wait for that one.
Yes,
I can't wait to see how that works out.
Looking forward to that.
I think those wolves are going to get a spanking.
Yeah, those wolves, which, you know, obviously look just like what's coming up. Oh, wait, no, they don't.
No.
So that's going to be interesting. So let's get to that.
Now we get back to... Right. Good. The elves. And the elves are... the sun is at the highest point, I guess, at this point, and the elves are rebelling against
the
orcs.
They're kind of like, wink, wink, it's time, it's time.
And they're pounding on those chains, and they're breaking those chains. And
orcs are kind of in there looking out like, hey, what's going on, guys? Hey, what's going on? Move it up, break it up.
They end up doing kung fu with the chains and tripping out the orcs that are going to attack them and using the sunlight, and they end up in a chain tug of war with the orcs. This is all very well done, mind you.
It sounds
a little silly, but damn, you saw it, so, or else you wouldn't be listening to this. But anyway, Arandir, his chain is broken and he flies through the air and he chops up that canopy. And
he runs up one of the chains someone else is holding to get up there. It's a really well done shot.
It's like a little Legolas thing.
And we're talking good Legolas, like from Lord of the Rings, not like, you know, from Battle of the Five Armies.
So they're getting the upper hand on the orcs, and the orcs, of course, say, release the wog.
Right. There's also a bit where Ardenir grabs a broken stick. Arandir grabs a broken stick to... shove it into one of the orcs' throats and use as a weapon. It's great.
Oh yeah. So and now they release the wog, and we hear this, like, it sounds more like a wild boar to me, but damn, this thing is American werewolf in London with a thyroid condition. It's got those eddy eyes from Lion King. They're going in the wrong direction. They're like bulging out. but that thing looked nasty.
It and when it attacks someone, it tears their stomach open. We see guts falling all over the place. It just makes the paper cut on the throat deck seem even worse. I gotta tell you, it's just clearly they're showing blood and guts, yes. Like graphically.
Right.
This is you know, borderlining on Game of Thrones level.
Right. Right. Well, I think it's right there. I mean, the thing's ripping out people's stomachs.
Yeah, we see intestines real fast. We see intestines on the ground.
Yeah, real fast too. And so, but not around here.
No, not around here.
He does like that side swipey thing. And he gets to the other side, and he ends up ensnaring it in a chain. But that thing's, like, eating through the chain. And Revion breaks free. Well, he helps Revion break free by stabbing an orc in the neck. And then eventually that warg does break free. But Revion's about to get gored.
Yeah.
His guts ripped out, but... Whoosh, spear.
I think that this...
Rondir kills it with a spear.
I believe this whole scene is a lesson. Kids, if you find a baby warg in the woods,
they look
leave
cute.
Him alone.
They look cute when they're young.
Leave him alone.
Yeah.
He's not going to be your friend.
No. Again, they look cute when they're little. When they get big, yeah. And so he kills it, but it's to no avail because... Revion is going to get shot with a couple of arrows.
Yes, he gets the Boromir treatment.
Right. And so he dead. And Arondir, almost dead, gets pulled back into the orc pit, into the trench. And they're about to cut his throat, but no. No, bring him to Adar. And they're all chanting Adar's name, and you see from behind Adar is approaching, and he
does not look like an orc.
No, he looks like an elf, and we see a front shot of him, which is blurry, and that's when the episode ends. So, Jude, you got a couple of things that you wanted to add in to analyze a couple of things.
Yes. Well, first of all, I think Adar, the name. To go back to that, meaning father, it's an interesting title for the episode because while we don't learn much about who Adar is or why they call him Adar, what we do get is a lot of father and child moments in the episode not related to him directly. We get all of the stuff with Elendil and his children. We get Miriel and her father, even for a brief period of time, and we at least know that this is a significant factor in the story that's going to be coming. And I feel that the title of the episode is rather aptly made, it's rather aptly named, given what it really is about. So I think that's a kind of a fitting for this episode.
Right. So also what I like to add is that there's a bunch of background, for example, on Numenor, on the White Tree of Numenor, on the king that's locked in the tower, and Miriel, and Ar-Pharazôn. A lot of things that we want to get into and discuss.
Just Pharazôn for now.
Yeah. And but he's going to eventually, we'll see. I don't want to spoil it. And I don't know if it's going to follow the text. But we like to talk a little bit about the lore. And we're going to do that in the Helm's Deep Dive. So you should join us there for that analysis. Anyway, this has been a pretty long episode. And we're going to leave it at that. I think that... Jude is going to take us out with a couple of things, but before that, I'd just like to say, remember the JRR You Talking to Me podcast. My name is Rob Law, and I would like to bid you a fond farewell and adieu.
And I'm Jude Fox. And I just want to remind all of our listeners to please like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating wherever you find your podcasts, share to help grow the fellowship. And if you want to contact us, you can find us at youtalkintome@gmail.com, as well as the JRR You Talking to Me About the Fellowship group on Facebook. And with that, bye-bye.